And welcome to week two of what we're calling Season to Taste, which I think you'll agree is an incredibly witty pun on the idea of seasons as a grouping of Doctor Who stories.
Should it be Series to Taste for the new series?
It'll still be Season to Taste. Okay. So we're 1 week in to our project to watch one story from every one of Doctor Who's 35 years of active 35 service.
Glorious years
of active service in its golden 50th anniversary year. God bless her and all who sail in her. So last week we determined through lengthy reasoned debate and arbitrary decision making to watch the year 34 story from the Matt Smith second series, A Good Man Goes to War. And in the spirit of celebration and positivity, Matt, what did you enjoy about A Good Man Goes to War?
I thought Dorian and the Sontaran and the Cylesbian were quite fun new characters.
It's not Cylesbian. I think you'll find they're actually called Eodikes.
The cave munchers.
I should so cut you saying that, and I'm not going to. No, I agree. I wasn't a massive fan of Dorian, but I did like Strax in particular. Although I'm already going to go off the positivity angle because I really enjoyed Strax. I thought he was very entertaining. I thought his death was very fitting. And therefore I'm completely baffled at the let's bring him back in the snowmen with a casual throwaway line that he's been brought back to life. If you kill a character off, then tough. Really, I mean, obviously you can contrive to bring them back, but I think if you thought Strax was a good character and wanted to use him again, the way to handle that is to not kill him off, because it devalues his death scene in retrospect. And, you know, it's a time travel series. Actually, you could have just had him in The Snowmen earlier in his life.
Well, I think it's a kind of thing with modern sci-fi series. It's the same in things like Buffy and, I guess, Fringe or whatever, where Buffy's death actually has no... Death has no meaning, and I think Stephen Moffat's very much of the opinion that actually, you know, I'll kill someone off this week, but I can bring them back next week. You could argue it kind of devalues your investment in the characters when you know, well, if they die this week, they'll probably come back.
But it certainly it certainly has the potential to devalue any death scenes where you go, well, they're supposed to be dead, but Rory's died X times.
What I was going to say is kind of, you know, you're watching a series where the central character, if he dies, he comes back, so... Yeah,
it's a little different, isn't it? I thought there were some nice witty moments in it. There were some nice lines. I did like Madame Vastra. There were some good moments. I fear that kind of some of the moments, while good in a kind of self-contained way, like the exploding cyberships, when you expressed last week some concerns about the way that reflects on the Doctor's character, and I kind of agree. It's one of those things that at the moment that it happens, it's fun and interesting, and it's a nice moment, and in a big macho film would be the kind of, you know, in Die Hard, a big explosion like that would be great.
It's the kind of punch there.
Yeah, absolutely. But then the moment you stop and go, well, hang on, this is the Doctor, and even if he's supposed to be angry, then it's still...
But the whole episode is meant to be... It's bizarrely about the Doctor behaving wildly out of character, so it justifies the thing about him rising so high and falling so far, because he's never behaved like that before. The whole story is basically the Doctor gets a bunch of people we've never met before to form an army to fight a bunch of other people we've never met before, all as 45 minutes of vamping to stop River revealing who she basically is.
And actually, it's odd, because we get the big speech about him rising so high and falling so far. He doesn't seem to rise particularly high, and he certainly doesn't seem to fall particularly far.
No. You made a comment while we were watching it that as long as you watch it with no knowledge or memory of any other Doctor Who story ever, then you can appreciate it on its own merits. But when you watch it and you're supposed to see the Doctor, this is a characteristic of the Doctor that he's been heading in this direction for a while. It doesn't fit with anything else, even in the 34th year or whatever we're calling it. Certainly not anything in the previous 49 or whatever years of the show.
Yeah, I found it rather overloaded with characters as well, which is perhaps by the nature of the way he's filled the army. But even on top of that, on the other side, you've got people like the thin one and the fat one, who, to be honest, I didn't feel was a particularly exciting inclusion of gay characters in Doctor Who. I slightly embarrassed by them. And the general and all the headless monks who kind of... It's a very complicated...
Well, the big surprise about the headless monks is that they're headless.
I was shocked at that moment.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. But, you know, you've got... And it's very hard to follow when you've got Madame Kaverin, you've got all of the clerics, you've got the headless monks, you're not quite sure... I'm not quite sure where the silence fits
well,
in.
Well, exactly. What really annoyed me about it is that Madame Kaverin says that Melody Pond is... going to be bred as a soldier in the endless war against the Doctor. But what endless war? We've never seen this unheard of endless war with the Doctor. Madame Kaverin's presumably something to do with the Silence, because she was in the last couple of episodes with the Silence in, and yet they don't appear in this episode. It's very difficult. I think particularly if maybe you're a kid and you're trying to follow who's who and what's what in the series, it's frustrating when, you know, these big, quite cool monsters are introduced in the first couple of episodes, and then it's some woman with an eye patch. I mean, it's not exactly...
Who are the Silence?
I can't remember.
Anyway, good to see that the boy from the Pirate Memory Games got better, so although he couldn't leave the ship before, he now can.
Yeah.
But then that's, you know, time passes. I liked the repeated use of the flesh twist. I liked Madame Kaverin going, ha-ha, I managed to fool you with it twice.
I thought
it was nice, because actually you've successfully fooled a chunk of the audience with that, and that's a proper twist. That's a twist done well. What you probably haven't fooled as much of a proportion of the audience with is the revelation of who Melody Pond is. I have to say, the very first time I saw that episode, I went into it saying, well, I imagine what we're going to find out is that Amy's daughter is River Song. And then in that first scene where she says, Melody Pond, I went... Well, Melody, Song, Pond, River, then, straight away. It's just not a massive revelation. And yet you have all that weird stuff with the cot and the Gallifreyan writing and the Doctor going all cooey over River Song herself that I just don't really follow. And to be honest, I don't think there's an episode of Doctor Who you can't make worse by putting River Song in it.
Well, I think the conceit of River Song is a kind of joke, isn't it, when it comes up in Silence in the Library, is this woman... presumably a companion or someone important from the future that the Doctor's never met.
Because it's time travel,
and it kind of works in that context. It's when she keeps turning up, and when she becomes... I think this was badged as the year of River Song. It was River Song's story this year. And actually, it's not that interesting.
It's not coherent either. And when you have a story, you need to be able to work out what's going on, and you can't solve... Someone mentioned on Twitter the other day, they kind of thought they got their head round the River Song timeline for a brief moment, but you can't, because they are flatly contradictory. And you have things like I mentioned last time about that moment where they kiss and she says, you know, I know this is the last time I'll get to kiss you because we're travelling in opposite directions, and yet there's nothing in any other episode. Again, within the self-contained episode, that makes sense. But as soon as you put them next to the other River Song episodes, she isn't travelling in opposite directions. They're just meeting each other at odd intervals.
No, well, she's in this episode, she's got the time bracelet on her wrist that she gets in the Pandorica Open. She buys it off Dorian.
So definitely
clearly
set
this after. Doesn't take place before that episode. So immediately the series is contradicting itself. I guess my big I have a load of problems with this particular series of Doctor Who. I think it was an interesting idea, but I think the execution, I think we said last week, I think it really suffered through the chopping and changing that happened with run times. But I also think, having just rewatched this week, A Good Man Goes to War, that the coherence of the ongoing story really falls apart, because the Silence don't appear in this episode, and it's not clear how things start to relate to each other.
That's fair enough. And perhaps then we choose a good one. We choose one that is kind of representative of that season. Well, I did enjoy watching it again. It was nice to see it. There were some good performances. I do like Strax, and I did enjoy him coming back, even if I thought I had actually forgotten he got killed in A Good Man Goes to War when I was watching The Snowman. But I enjoy it, but there are a lot of things that annoy me, and I do find River Song often like fingernails down a blackboard, which does make it slightly hard to watch her episodes.
So, Will, what have we got in store this week?
Well, there's only one way to find out, and that is to consult the randomizer.
The randomizer.
I've switched the randomizer on, it's humming away, and it's ready, and once again, it's ready to pick us a number from 1 to 35 to represent the 35 years of Doctor Who, roughly speaking. We've already done number 34, which was Series 6, or the second Matt Smith series. And if you're ready, I will ask the randomizer to pick a number.
Let's do it.
Oh my word. You can hear it in my voice.
I know what this is going to be.
Have a guess.
23.
It's 23! Wow. The Trial of a Time Lord.
Well, I suppose on the basis that things can only get better, we've got the worst of the new series out of the way, and we're now going to get the worst of the old series, so...
Let's not prejudge it. So, I have defined on my spreadsheet season 23 as the four... I had said four in the last week, and you didn't correct me. Obviously, The Trial of a Time Lord is one story. It's 14 episodes long. It's three production codes, 7A, 7B, and 7C, for parts 1 to 4, parts 5 to 9, 5 to 8, and parts 9 to 14. But it's been traditionally viewed as four
DVD's
stories.
Yeah, the DVD's on four discs.
And there are four novelisations.
Yeah, and they've all got their own little titles that are kind of being fanonised, haven't they?
So I think we'll go with four, shall we? And that gives us what we'll then refer to as The Mysterious Planet, Mind Warp, Terror of the Vervoids, and The Ultimate Foe.
Yeah.
Now, the obvious thing to do would be to pick The Ultimate Foe, simply on the grounds that it's only two episodes. But this is about celebrating Doctor Who, and about we're going to have a way to watch it. We're not trying to not watch it. So, the length of episodes aside, would you like to pitch for one of those four?
Well, it's funny that you say that the last two-parter, because The Ultimate Foe actually has quite a lot going for it. Episode 13 is Robert Holmes' final writing assignment for the series. Episode 14, famously, has a really convoluted history. Pip and Jane Baker were brought in to write it because Eric Saward had originally written it based on Robert Holmes' notes for episode 14.
Fall into a hole at the end.
Yeah, presumably. Well, I think, yeah, there was something around the Doctor and the Valyard pitching over the edge, like Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty.
I mean, I don't want to... I think we assume too much of what Pip and Jane Baker must have brought to that episode, because I'm pretty sure Megabyte Modem came from Robert Holmes. And Catharsis of Spurious Morality is definitely one of his.
Well, famously, they had to sign a disclaimer before they were even asked to write the episode, and they weren't allowed to see any of the script for episode 14, as originally it was laid out.
To
by
make
Robert
sure
Holmes
they didn't accidentally
to
plagiarise
make sure
it.
Accidentally, unconsciously plagiarise. Yeah. But I think episode 14, as Robert Holmes wrote it, made the Valyards.
I slightly
origins
wonder,
more
were
clear.
Pip and Jane allowed to see the scripts of episodes 1 to 13 before they saw episode 14?
I'm not sure if they even read Terror of the Vervoids more than as it was leaving their fingers onto the screen.
Anyway, once again, in the celebration of Golden Doctor Who, rather than being pitchy.
But no, just finishing off on The Ultimate Foe, so I think episode 14 obviously would have revealed that the Valyard is not some bizarre Matrix projection, but is indeed a future Doctor. It was supposed to be the Doctor right at the end of his regeneration, so on the verge of death, and actually looking back and saying, well, I could have done so much more. Yeah. So...
Because it is slightly, it's slightly problematic idea. To say, let's create a character who is a kind of dark, unlikable, angry version of the Doctor.
And put him against Michael Jason. But I think, you know, that's a really interesting thing to do, to actually have the Doctor right at the end of his life, because it's kind of, it almost is the ultimate story. What would you do if you were faced with yourself
particularly
about to die?
You can imagine the Doctor thinking, and even other people saying to him, well, as they characters do at the end of The Case of Andrew's Army, you know, you're too important, you mustn't die, you do so much good. If you can artificially extend your life, then maybe it's worth doing.
But we'll never know now, because Robert Holmes died.
Well, we're only two more incarnations away.
True. So what else have we got? We've got The Mysterious Planet, Robert Holmes' final full story, and I think it's quite underrated. Robert Holmes gets the trial concept really well and makes the whole thing a critique, and quite an amusing critique of Doctor Who. The Mysterious Planet, the Ravalox bits, are almost incidental. It's meant, in my view, to be a very generic Doctor Who story and Doctor Who setup, and actually what Robert Holmes is doing. He's making the most of the trial scenes, and the real meat and potatoes of that story are in the Doctor's confrontations with the Valyard, and through the Valyard with Time Lords in general, which are always, you know, Robert Holmes pretty much invented that version of the Time Lords, where they're this evil, corrupt society. So I think Mysterious Planet's quite interesting.
Yeah, I could see that. And obviously we've got Joan Sims and the return of Duggan from City of Death, and Glitz and Diver introduced. We've got Mind Warp, obviously quite a fun and dark Philip Martin story, the return of Syl, Perry's writing out death stroke marriage to...
I really hate that.
Icarnos. You hate the marriage or you hate killing her?
I'm ambivalent about the marriage to Icarnos. I hate killing Perry. Partly because I dislike killing companions in general.
I do.
Because I think the point isn't to introduce someone you invest in to kill them off. I think Adric, they'd done Adric, what, 2 or 3 years previously. I don't think there was any call to kill another companion off straight away.
But you should feel more positive about the marriage then, because obviously the killing as a trick in The Matrix is part of the trial story, but the fact that she's not dead at all means that...
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, let's face it, it's unconvincing. It's one of many unconvincing companion romances in Doctor Who that have gone back to probably Susan
and
David
Campbell
back in 1964.
Yeah. Oh, we just met, or we're getting married. Oh, Leela and Andred.
Yeah.
The only one that is convincing is
Joan Cliff. Joe Jones.
George Jones.
And Cliff Wood.
She's up on the slag heap with the professor. And obviously Mel and Glitz, that's a particular convincing one.
Yeah.
She's a dirty girl.
He needed a new dipper.
And it should have just gone to the garden centre, really. Yeah, it's obviously got things going for it. It's got Patrick Reichardt. Yeah, it's got those nice kind of Quantel effects. And it has its positive points. Then we have Agatha Christie on a spaceship.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just there. She wasn't... It's nothing to do with the writing. Yes, Honor Blackman, that guy from Lovejoy, all having fun trying to work out who's controlling the Vervoids and doing the killings.
No one's controlling the Vervoids. The point is, well, one of the problems with the story is that the Vervoids have got a mind of their own, so they're not really a murder weapon. They are a bunch of murderers with a motive of their own. So the whole Agatha Christie thing starts to fall apart because there is no clear mystery and clear solution.
And then back to the Ultimate Foe. Obviously, I do like the Master appearing on the big screen and trying to hypnotise Glitz. The Mr. Popowick stuff, Colin's very good, is Dickensian quoting. But
let's not beat around the bush, because essentially
we're carefully considering all of the options before we decide
that the Ultimate Foe is the shortest one and therefore definitely the one.
It's also my favourite bit, I think. Again, we don't have any set criteria, but it is kind of representative. It's obviously focused on the trial plot more than anything else. And so it's representative of the trial season. Focusing on the Valyard and on the trial plot is probably the right way to go, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we're probably not going to pick Time in the Rani, I guess, when we get to season 24. So Pip and Jane are important writers of that period of the show, whether you like it or not. And it's worthwhile having a look at some of their work if we're going to go and look at every year.
Okay, well, that seems the apposite decision. So, Pip and Jane and... Is it Robert Holmes, episode 13?
Robert Holmes, episode 13. Pip and Jane, episode 14. And episode 14 is 5 minutes long. It's 30 minutes long. John Nathan Turner got a special dispensation from the head of serials or whatever it was to extend the episode so that they could wrap up all of the plot threads in a satisfactory manner. So let's take a look at how that turned out.
Okay, well, I will dig out the DVD, and if you pop out for some carrot juice, we'll be all set.
Woo!
Episodes 13 and 14 of The Trial of a Time Lord, it is from season 23. Bye-bye.
Bye.